How sound can hinder or help neurodivergent employees, entrepreneurs, and creators at work. Welcome to the Unmasked Playbook. Hello and welcome to this, the second post for the Unmasked Playbook, a group dedicated to helping neurodivergent employees, entrepreneurs, creators, and other members of our community who are trying to survive and thrive in a working environment that was just not designed for the way in which our brains process information. I am Paul Greystoke, fiction author under the pen name PJ Greystoke, entrepreneur and father to two amazing children. I am also ADHD, which is both autistic and ADHD, and have overcome many challenges to get where I am today. I started the Unmasked Playbook to share some of the answers I have found over the years and to benefit from the collective wisdom of our ever-growing community, to find solutions to conquer some of the barriers many of us still struggle with. These posts combine the most up-to-date psychological research with practical lived-in experience from our members to provide a roadmap to success in the workplace. This week, how sound can hinder or help neurodivergent employees, entrepreneurs, and creators at work. Noise is not simply a matter of volume. Control, predictability, meaning, and the task in front of us can determine whether sound supports a neurodivergent brain or consumes the very capacity needed to work. The sound nobody else seems to notice. Do you work happily with music filling the room and then find a quiet tapping pen almost impossible to tolerate? From the outside, that can look inconsistent. If loud sound is acceptable, why should a much quieter one be a problem? The answer, emerging from research, is that volume is only part of the experience. Whether a sound is chosen or imposed, predictable or sudden, controllable or inescapable, can matter just as much. So can its meaning and the kind of work we are attempting when it occurs. For neurodivergent people, like me, this is not merely about preference. Background speech, ringing telephones, music selected by somebody else, machinery, footsteps, a neighbor's midday DIY, or the overlapping sounds of an open plan office can compete for the same limited cognitive resources needed to remember, speak, decide, and create. The work may still get done, but at a much greater cost. Noise does not merely interrupt concentration. Sometimes it removes access to the part of the brain that knew what it was trying to do. That cost matters wherever work happens. In an office or school, behind a shop counter, inside a vehicle, at a kitchen table, in a studio, or at a cafe. Even working alone or for yourself does not necessarily mean you have control of the environment around you. When sound becomes cognitive load. Research into open plan offices repeatedly identifies irrelevant speech, chatter, and telephones as major sources of distraction. A 2023 review found that these sounds were among the most commonly reported problems in shared offices, affecting concentration, comfort, and perceived productivity. It is important to note here that this is not exclusive to neurodivergent workers. Background speech can disrupt working memory for almost anyone, but the consequences may be especially significant for people who already find filtering competing information difficult. Autism and ADHD should not be collapsed into one explanation. Autism research points towards differences across several stages of auditory processing, including the difficulty some autistic people experience separating one voice from surrounding sound. ADHD research more often focuses on attentional control, inhibition, and working memory. Hearing the sound is not necessarily the problem. Preventing it from capturing the attention may be. Neither account is complete. Studies vary, individuals vary, and unfortunately for me, ADHD has very little dedicated auditory research of its own. What we can say safely is that unwanted sound can consume processing capacity. Once that capacity is occupied, reading becomes harder, instructions disappear, Speech may become less accessible and returning to an interrupted task takes additional effort, or in some cases can be quite impossible. The importance of the task came through very clearly in one community discussion with the Unmasked Playbook. Chris, not his real name, described being unable to take in conversation whilst driving, even if the subject was fascinating. That is a useful reminder that sound tolerance cannot be separated from cognitive demand. Driving already requires continual visual scanning, decisions, and motor responses. Adding conversation may push some people beyond their available processing capacity. In safety-critical situations, the right strategy may be to reduce conversation and audio, rather than trying harder to divide attention. So, what may help? Do not begin by asking whether you are too sensitive to noise. Begin with the task. For one working week, note the sound, what you were doing, what happened to your performance, and how long it took you to recover. Patterns are often a lot more useful than a single label. Employers can support this by treating concentration problems as an environmental design question, not a character judgment. Why control changes the experience? Long-standing experimental work on stress shows that unpredictable and uncontrollable noise produces greater strain than sound people can anticipate or stop. Even believing that escape is available can reduce the effect. This helps explain why self-selected music may be regulating, whilst somebody else's much quieter sounds become unbearable. Control is not simply an on-off switch. It includes knowing when a sound will begin, how long it will last, whether we can lower it, whether we are allowed to move, and whether asking for change will bring social consequences. An employee may technically be able to request a quieter desk, yet fear being considered difficult. A home worker may own the room but have no control over neighbours, children, traffic, or construction. So, what may help? And employers, I'm talking to you here as well. Increase predictability, even when noise cannot be removed. Give advance warning of alarm tests, construction, machinery, or unusually busy periods. Agree quiet focus blocks. Allow someone to move before overload rather than after it. For solo workers, create a backup location or a short list of tasks that can still be completed when the preferred sound environment is unavailable. ADHD. With more sound can mean more focus. Silence is often assumed to be the ideal condition for concentration. For some people with ADHD, it is not. A 2024 systematic review and meta-analysis of 13 studies involving 335 children and young adults found a small improvement in laboratory task performance when participants with ADHD or elevated attention difficulties heard white or pink noise. Participants without ADHD showed a small decline. This finding is promising, but it is not a universal prescription. The studies were largely conducted with young people in controlled tasks, not adults completing a working day. One possible explanation is called scholastic resonance. In plain English, this is the idea that a small amount of background noise may sometimes make a weak brain signal easier to register. It remains a theory and has been challenged by newer research, and I shall keep you informed as this research progresses. What do white, pink, brown noise, what do they all actually mean? The colour names sound scientific, but the basic idea is straightforward. They describe how a continuous sound spreads its energy across low and high pitches. They do not describe different treatments. And a colour that helps one person may well irritate or overwhelm another. White noise contains energy across the full range of audible pitches. Because our ears notice its higher frequency strongly, it usually sounds like a bright hiss or radio static, a fan or steady shower spray. It can cover changing background sounds, but some people find it sharp or tiring. Pink noise reduces the energy as the pitch rises, giving more weight to the lower frequencies than white noise. It often sounds softer and more balanced, rather like steady rain, wind through trees, or a distant waterfall. Pink noise has been studied alongside white noise in ADHD research, but the average benefit found was small and does not predict what any one adult will experience. This research into pink noise did make me wonder, though. Some adult sound preferences may also have their roots in childhood. A child who repeatedly turns to the sound of rain, a fan, wind in the trees, or another steady background during sleep, concentration, or distress may gradually associate that soundscape with safety and regulation. What began as an instinctive or learned childhood coping strategy can therefore remain useful in adult working life, even if the person is never consciously identified as such. There's a Christmas album my grandmother and parents used to play when I was a child. Hearing it now as an adult has a very calming effect and can help reduce overwhelm and enable me to refocus on the task in hand. Brown noise places still more emphasis on low frequencies, producing a deeper rumble that may resemble heavy rainfall, distant thunder, or the sound inside an aircraft. The name comes from Brownian motion, a scientific term for random movement. It is not a reference to the color brown. It is popular in ADHD communities, but direct evidence for its effect on attention is currently much weaker than online claims suggest. Blue and violet noise emphasize higher frequencies and therefore sound brighter, thinner, and sharper than white noise. They are less commonly used for concentration and may be uncomfortable for people who are sensitive to high-pitched sound. Grey noise is shaped to compensate roughly for the way human hearing notices some pitches more easily than others. The aim is for the range to feel more evenly loud, even though the result varies between recordings, headphones, and individual hearing. Green noise does not have one widely agreed scientific definition. Online, the label is usually applied to nature-like sound with strong middle frequency range. Two tracks, both called green noise, therefore might sound quite different. These descriptions are useful starting points, not precise promises about how a particular video or app will sound. What works for one may be considered intrusive to another. Experiment and see what works for you. Speakers, headphones, recording methods, and volume all change the experience too. Nature sounds and ambient music may perform a similar masking or regulating role, but they are not automatically examples of a particular noise color. I can find the natural sound of rain lightly tapping on my window quite soothing, but will often find the same sound when recorded rather irritating. Music presents a similarly individual picture. A 2024 communications biology study found that music containing particular rapid amplitude modulations, very fast deliberate rises and falls in volume, supported sustained attention differently depending on a listener's attentional difficulties. That doesn't mean one engineered playlist will work for everyone. Familiarity, preference, stimulation level, and task all matter. One finding is more dependable. Lyrics tend to interfere with language-heavy work. Controlled research published in 2023 found that music with lyrics hindered verbal and visual memory and reading comprehension, whilst instrumental lo-fi music produced no credible improvement or impairment. A soundtrack that supports repetitive admin and office sounds may therefore obstruct writing, editing, and reading. What members of the Unmasked Playbook use in practice? I have replaced the names of our members with made-up ones in this section to protect their identity and prevent any unwanted and accelerated rise to fame and stardom. David Daniels, not his real name, uses the Calm app to play ambient music through noise-cancelling headphones, and finds almost all other noise obstructive while he is concentrating. The combination matters. The headphones reduce unpredictable external input, while the chosen track supplies a steady, controlled soundscape. It is not simply a matter of adding music, it is replacing unwanted sound with something predictable. Mark Milner, a sonic artist and audio technician, gravitates towards modulated brown and pink noise, low to mid-bass bass frequencies and slowly shifting drone music, usually with little speech or singing. This fits the task-based evidence better than searching for a universe or playlist. Low frequency sound may feel less sharp, sparse vocals reduce competition with language, and gradual modulation can offer stimulation without abrupt interruption. These are personal observations, not proof that the same sounds will regulate everyone. Susan Sorbet uses nature sounds such as rain, wind, and water washing over pebbles. She also sometimes protects demanding concentration work for the night, when both the soundscape and the social demands are calmer. If changing hours is possible, timing can be as important as the audio itself. A reliable quiet period may reduce the amount of filtering the brain must perform before any chosen sound is added. Susan also described regulating one sense through another. Using rosemary or peppermint scent and holding a thumbstone, textured crystal or fir cone. This expands the idea of a sound menu into a sensory menu. A stable tactile object may give attention somewhere predictable to settle, while a chosen scent can become a grounding cue. These should be treated as individual experiments, not treatments. Strong fragrances can trigger headaches, asthma, allergies, or sensory distress in other people. So, scent is best kept personal and used only when it is safe and permitted. Some members favor music labeled 432 Hz or 528 Hz. Research into frequency-specific music is emerging, but claims of unique healing or attention-enhancing properties currently run ahead of this evidence. A 2026 study found that listening to music at all these frequencies produced different measurable changes in the students' bodies, but did not improve their performance on an attention test. If a particular track helps, use it. The useful features may include its tempo, timbre, repetition, familiarity and personal associations, as well as its tuning. Judge by its effect on the task and on your nervous system. Let's try a task-based experiment. Test three conditions on the same kind of task. Quiet instrumental music and one steady noise color at a comfortable volume. Compare the quality of the work, not only how productive you felt, if the sound causes discomfort, ringing, increased agitation, or makes it harder to notice something important. If that happens, stop or lower it. Keep lyrics away from reading and writing until you know they do not interfere. And, I suppose I should say, use sound as an optional working tool, never as a replacement for established ADHD treatment or professional advice. Autism, when ordinary sound becomes overload. For many autistic workers, the central problem is not insufficient stimulation, but excessive layered or unpredictable input. No individual sound needs to be particularly loud. Conversations, ventilation, footsteps, printers, telephone alerts, and movements can combine until the environment demands more processing than is available. At that point, the effect is not limited to annoyance. Concentration may collapse, speech can become harder, irritability may rise as the nervous system attempts to protect itself. Some people withdraw or shut down. Others continue to mask the distress until they reach home, where the delayed cost becomes visible. Years of teaching in a secondary school before I was diagnosed outlined this very point. I would often come home, close the curtains, and block out as much sound and stimulation as possible while I lay down and try to calm my elevated heart rate. Noise-reducing technology is one practical response, but the direct research is still very small. A study of noise-attenuating headphones in autistic children with auditory hypersensitivity found reductions in the body's signs of stress, which supports the experience as more than a subjective preference, but it does not justify claiming that headphones are a proven solution for every autistic adult at work. Some autistic people are also sensory seeking, or less sensitive to sound. Others may move between seeking and avoiding, depending on fatigue, stress, and the task. A quiet room imposed on everybody can be as unhelpful as office-wide music. So, what may help? Again, this is also talking to employers here. Offer choices. Noise-cancelling headphones, earplugs, a quieter desk, a low-stimulation room, remote or flexible hours, and advance warning of unavoidable sound. Do not insist that one adjustment suits every autistic person. Review what works, because tolerance can change with cumulative stress and burnout. Or ADHD, wanting stimulation and protection at the same time. Or ADHD can create an awkward tension, and don't I know it. The ADHD side may seek stimulation to begin or sustain a task, while the autistic side may become overwhelmed by the same input. That is not hypocrisy or inconsistency. It may simply mean that the useful level and the type of stimulation has a narrow window, and that window moves. The sound that starts a task may not be the sound that completes it. Fast music might generate enough momentum to begin an administrative job, while instrumental ambience is better once attention is settled. Creative thinking may benefit from a moderate hum, while precise editing needs near silence. Susan's approach illustrates that flexibility. At times, she invites predictable sound and balances it with touch or scent. When that is not enough, she uses earplugs or filtered ear devices to reduce the world around her. The aim is not to remain loyal to either stimulation or silence. It is to match the input to the task and to the capacity available on that particular day. Build a sound menu. Instead of searching for one perfect soundtrack, choose options by function. Activation, sustained focus, verbal work, repetitive admin, emotional regulation, and recovery. Include silence as one of the options, rather than treating it as a default. On difficult days, lower the number of stimulus inputs, before lowering the expectations of yourself. And what about when the noise is social? While reading this research, I found myself thinking about client meetings of the past. An hour could contain 10 minutes of useful work and 50 minutes covering a dog's name, a child's favourite food, petrol prices, politics, and almost anything except the reason we were meeting. I understood that small talk was expected, but I experienced it as something imposed upon the task. This led me to an idea. Small talk can sometimes function as social noise. It is information we did not choose, cannot easily control, and are not permitted to ignore. This is a connective insight rather than established scientific finding. No study located for this article has tested small talk using the same experimental methods used for unwanted noise. However, adjacent research helps explain why the comparison may feel accurate. Relevance theory suggests that conversation becomes harder when two people have different assumptions about what information matters. To the client, talking about family or petrol may not be pointless at all. It may be performing relational work by establishing warmth and trust. To the autistic professional, the meeting may have an informal purpose: to find the problem, exchange what is needed, and reach a decision. Neither person is necessarily communicating badly. They are just judging signals and filler by different rules. Research associated with a double empathy problem supports the broader idea that communication difficulties can arise from a mismatch between neurotypes rather than a one-sided autistic deficit. Small talk also demands more than passive tolerance. The listener must help produce it. Generate questions, display interest, monitor tone, choose the right moment to respond, and judge when it's safe to return to the agenda. It can therefore become both unwanted input and compulsory performance. The unmasked playbook community responses also show why one description cannot fit everybody. Rowena Wright, again, not her real name, enjoys brief exchanges with dog walkers, cashiers, and neighbours, but finds longer small talk quite draining. Wilfred West tends to answer, "How are you?" quite literally, exposing the hidden convention that the question often asks for a ritual rather than a full report on his actual feelings. Carol Cole needs context and time before she can simply chat, and may withdraw when an unstructured visit feels overwhelming or carries the fear of saying the wrong thing. Duration, purpose, predictability, and the possibility of leaving all change the demand. I recognize the value of a very short, stable script. A security guard at a shop I visit regularly and I always have exactly the same exchange. He asks whether I'm all right. I say that I am, and I ask him the same. And he replies, "Champion, man, champion." My daughter once observed that we seem to get on very well, and we do, as well as that relationship needs to. The exchange works because it is friendly, brief, and predictable. If he ever departed from that script, I am not entirely sure what I would do. Small talk can be the social equivalent of unwanted background noise. Information you did not choose, cannot control, and are not permitted to ignore. So, what may help? Share an agenda and a clear finish time before meetings. Put informal conversations inside a predictable boundary rather than allowing it to occupy the entire session. Laura Lane suggested signalling another appointment at the outset, even if it is fictional. The most sustainable version is to state an honest time boundary and what the conversation must achieve. Accept written contributions before and after meetings. If scripts help, prepare an opening, a transition, and a closing line, such as, "I want to make sure we cover what you need today, so shall we move on to the first item?" Susan learned to ask colleagues about familiar subjects such as dogs, holidays, and weekends, but she was masking to avoid workplace penalties. Scripts should therefore be optional tools, not tests of warmth. Build recovery time after socially demanding meetings instead of booking them back to back. Working for yourself does not remove the problem. Research on noise and neurodivergence is heavily weighted towards conventional employees. Direct peer-reviewed evidence concerning neurodivergent entrepreneurs, freelancers, and creators is sadly remarkably thin. We should be honest about that gap rather than pretending that office studies examined writers working in cafes, as I have done, or business owners taking calls from home. Nevertheless, the practical problem is easy to recognize. Self-employment may remove one manager while introducing neighbors, family life, public workspaces, client calls, and the financial impossibility of maintaining a dedicated studio. A creator can control the playlist, but not the drilling next door. More apparent freedom does not always mean more actual control. Creative work is especially vulnerable to interruption because ideas must be held and developed across time. A sound does not only steal the seconds in which it occurs, it can break the chain connecting one thought to the next. Research on interrupted work shows that people often compensate by working faster while feeling more stressed, frustrated, and time pressured. So, what may help? Match location to task. Reserve the most controllable environment for writing, editing, design, or complex decisions. Keep portable tasks for noisy periods, scheduling, filing, image searches, or routine administration. Prepare a portable sound kit with headphones, earplugs, and downloaded audio so poor connectivity does not remove your backup. Protect a short, reliable focus window rather than waiting for an entire perfect day. The hidden social cost of asking for quiet. The sound itself is only part of the burden. Neurodivergent workers may also need to decide whether asking for help will make them appear antisocial, precious, uncooperative, or unprofessional. Qualitative research on workplace masking describes people suppressing visible signs of overload in order to meet expectations, with consequences for mental and physical well-being. Susan's experience makes that cost concrete. Before becoming self-employed, she says that her lack of small talk with colleagues was repeatedly identified as an area requiring development, and that affected her annual bonus. After a grievance brought no resolution, she learned to perform interest through a script. Her account illustrates how a workplace can reward visible social conformity rather than effective cooperation. An adjustment should reduce the need to mask, not merely teach somebody to imitate the expected ritual more convincingly. Headphones can be misread as rejection. Moving away from colleagues can be interpreted as rudeness. A request to turn down music can be treated as an attempt to control everyone else. The result is that some people endure an environment until overload becomes impossible to hide, at which point their reaction, rather than the conditions that produced it, become the problem. In the UK, ACAS, the public body that provides workplace advice, explicitly lists headphones, ear defenders, earplugs, quiet workspaces and noise-cancelling headphones among possible adjustments for neurodivergent workers. It also states that a worker does not need a formal diagnosis before support or reasonable adjustments are considered. Whether any particular adjustment is legally reasonable depends on the circumstances, but asking for a discussion is not asking for special treatment. So, what's a useful way to make this request? Describe the barrier, the effect on the work, and the adjustment you want to test. Something like, background conversations make it difficult for me to retain verbal information and complete concentration-heavy work. Could I use noise-cancelling headphones during focus periods and move to a quieter space for this task? I suggest we review it after 4 weeks. Employers should record the agreement and review effectiveness rather than demanding the person repeatedly justify the same need. Okay, create your own personal sound profile. There is no validated intervention called a personal sound profile. However, occupational therapy's established sensory processing frameworks support the underlying idea that people differ in what they seek, notice, tolerate, and avoid. Turning that principle into a practical record can help replace vague distress with usable information. So, for several days, record 4 things. The task, the sound environment, the effect, and the recovery consequence. Divide sounds into those that regulate, activate, distract, and overwhelm. Then ask what changes when the sound is chosen. Predictable, meaningful, or controllable. So regulating are sounds that settle your nervous system or help you recover. Activating, sounds that help you begin, transition, or maintain momentum. Distracting are sounds that repeatedly capture attention but remain tolerable. And overwhelming are sounds or combinations that impair speech, thought, regulation, or functioning. The purpose is not to diagnose yourself. Misophonia, hypercorsis, phonobia, auditory processing difficulties, sensory overload, and ordinary irritation are not interchangeable terms. If reactions are severe, painful, trigger-specific, or affecting daily life beyond ordinary distraction, please do seek appropriate professional assessment, rather than relying on social media checklists. As I have often advised my girlfriend, go Google, social media and AI is absolutely your friend, until it isn't. Turn the profile into a system. Choose one change for each category, a recovery sound, an activation playlist, protection from a common distraction, and an exit plan for overload. If employed, bring the task and impact evidence to adjustment conversations. If self-employed, use it to design your diary and workspace, rather than repeatedly blaming yourself when the environment and tasks are mismatched. What employers can change without redesigning the building? Many helpful changes are inexpensive. The strongest approach is not to guess what every autistic or ADHD employee needs, but to create options and remove unnecessary social penalties for using them. And what could they be? Allow headphones during agreed focus periods where safety and the role permits. Provide at least one quiet or low stimulation space that is not treated as a punishment room. Offer flexible seating away from kitchens, printers, doors, and high traffic routes. Give advance warning of alarms, building work, and unusual noisy activity. Reduce unnecessary audio notifications and provide written versions of important instructions. Protect concentration blocks and avoid scheduling demanding meetings back to back. Give meetings a clear purpose, agenda, and finish time, and do not treat limited small talk as poor teamwork when necessary work communication is effective. Do not impose one office playlist or assume that silence suits everybody. And ask what helps. Trial it. Review it. Needs can change with the task and the cumulative load. A neuro-inclusive workplace is not one silent room with a pair of headphones in it. It is a workplace that recognizes environmental control as part of how people access their abilities. The goal is not silence, it's choice and control. Unfortunately, current research does not support a universal sound solution. White noise helps some people and hinders others. Music can activate, regulate, or interfere. Headphones can provide relief, but will not redesign a hostile workplace. Silence can be restorative, distracting, or oppressive depending on the person and the task. The clearest principle is agency. Greater choice over what we hear, when we hear it, and how we can respond. For an employee, that may mean a reasonable adjustment. For an entrepreneur, it may mean building different environments around different kinds of work. For a creator, it may mean protecting the fragile conditions in which an idea can remain alive long enough to become something. Research tells us what tends to work. Our community tells us what actually works in real life. The Unmasked Playbook exists to bring those two forms of knowledge together. Neurodivergent do not necessarily need less sensory input. We need greater control over the sensory input we receive. So if you'd like to join the conversation, what is one sound most people barely notice that you find almost impossible to work through? And what sound do you actively rely on to concentrate, create, or recover? Please do share your experience with the Unmasked Playbook community. While your experience is not a clinical study, it may help somebody else recognize and describe a need they have spent years trying to ignore. And that's about it. I hope you found it useful. The Unmasked Playbook offers strategies, systems, and support for neurodivergent creators, entrepreneurs, and people in the workplace. Paul Greystoke, that is me, is an ADHD author, creator, and founder of the community. If you have found this useful and you think being part of an active neurodivergent community is something for you, then please do join us on Facebook. Just simply search for The Unmasked Playbook. And we shall see you soon.